I couldn't help but feel a little sad as the alcohol began to wear off. I wanted this moment to last forever. The laughing, the sips of premium champagne, the loud music, and carefree feelings. As I stood and watched Exhibit dance and jump around, greeting the fans who reached out to him, I noticed that the majority of the men around us were gay. There were a few gay couples scattered around the club, kissing and carrying on in dark corners. There were others dancing together on the dance floor, bumping and grinding. I flagged down Exhibit to share my revelation with him. I asked him, "Look around. Do you notice anything strange about this place?" He stopped dancing and took a second to look around the room. Soon enough, it hit him. "This looks like a gay club." I responded with a grin and a nod. This was Miami, after all. The grin soon turned into roaring laughter as Exhibit stood there in disbelief. "Did this motherfucker just bring us to a gay club?" he asked, laughing and laying aside, for a moment, the usual macho mantle that cloaks most rappers. Again, I responded with a loud roar of laughter. We finished the night at the club and soon made our way back to the Turnberry Resort. It was a night to remember, and we stayed up until about 9 in the morning, making love and laughing about the night we had out with Diddy. But it wasn't over yet. The next night would be Diddy's big New Year's Eve bash at the Shore Club. It was the first time I had ever seen X dressed formally, and he looked handsome. I wore a black strapless dress with a fish fin bottom. We were then chauffeured to the event and arrived in style and right on time. I found myself walking tall next to him on the receiving carpet. My back straightened even more as I noticed the young women Diddy had hired to stand on pedestals on either side of the entrance, dressed like angels. The party started in a large reception area and spilled out to the Olympic-sized pool. There were stilt walkers, fireworks, and synchronized swimmers. It was a magical night, and people came from all over the country to celebrate the new year with Diddy. There was free-flowing champagne and food for everyone. Exhibit and I drank, ate, and danced the night away. As usual, we would separate for a while and mingle on our own, then catch up with each other to report what we saw and who we spoke to. The night was filled with endless laughter and euphoria. By this time, I had not used drugs since my seizures 2 months earlier, and even though most everyone around me indulged in ecstasy, I stayed away. I did indulge, and maybe even overindulge, in the readily available champagne and liquor. By the end of the party, Exhibit and I were eager to get back to our suite and dive into each other. That's exactly what we did, and for the next week and a half, we were so into each other, I wanted it to continue once we returned to Los Angeles. What felt like months away in a tropical paradise quickly came to an end, however. On the last day of the vacation, January 3rd, 2002, I slowly packed my bags while holding back the tears. I had no stability to go back to and longed for a way to start over again. Exhibit and I sat across from each other in the living room of the suite. I watched him roll a blunt with precision and care so as not to damage the delicate tobacco leaves or spill the last of his weed. He began to go over the events of the last 2 weeks, recounting all the fun we'd had in Miami. Then he talked about the year that had just passed and all he expected out of 2002. X had great plans and ideas for his life, and we discussed his business goals and the money he would make and save. He had a 5-year plan, which laid out how his career would be built and its effect on his family, especially his young son, who he raises as a single dad. He had it all together, and the gleam in his eyes showed his enthusiasm and hopes for the future. As he came to the end of describing his 5-year plan, he looked up from his blunt and asked me, "So what's your plan?" Sadly enough, I had no answer because there wasn't a plan. All of my belongings were in storage and in the back of my car. I had no way to live and didn't have enough money to start over. As I sat there, terrified, watching him smoke his blunt, I fought back the biggest cry of my life. The flight back was long for me as I sat up in my first-class seat while X napped the whole way. My mind was racing, trying to figure out what I would do when we touched down in Los Angeles. The party was over, and I was the only one with nothing to do and nowhere to go. We pulled up to Exhibit's house, and I packed all of my things into the back seat of my car, gave him a long, deep hug, and said goodbye. He had a lot to do and was eager to get back to his life. Though I was longing to stay with him, it was back to the extended stay hotel for me. Once I arrived there, I placed a postcard of the Turnberry Resort on the mirror next to a picture of my son with Santa Claus, which we'd taken a few weeks before. I missed Miami as if it were my home, and I missed my son, wishing I could give him a home. My life was a mess. Chapter 15. I Choose Life. By February 2002, I had gotten used to living in and out of hotel rooms. I was in survival mode, but wasn't necessarily living. I had gone back to being an exotic dancer, hating every minute of it, but I had a little boy depending on me. However, out of the mud came a rose, and I slowly but surely started to dig my way out of that life. While in my hotel room just a few days after returning from Miami, I began rummaging through my belongings when I came across a shoebox that had been taped shut. In the box, I had stored a lot of memories, backstage passes, pictures, airline tickets, and the like. I opened the box and began sifting through this archive of my life and instantly began to cry. Here I was in this tiny room with all of my belongings stored in my car and my entire life stuffed into a shoebox. Everyone I knew, everywhere I had been, it was all there, and none of it worth anything anymore. None of it had gotten me any further in life. If anything, I had regressed and become less of a person than I was ever meant to be. I thought about how it all began and those first few months in Los Angeles, how all my life I had been running from one form of abuse to another, and how now I was the one abusing myself. Sitting on the floor, I cried, and it pained me so terribly that I rose to my knees and began to pray. I could barely get the words out for the sobbing, but I knew that he would hear me. I admitted things to myself that I had never confessed to before, and asked God to forgive me and help me get my life back. I begged him to show me the way and assured him that I was ready now to listen and to follow. I cried and prayed for 45 minutes, and by the end of the prayer, I was weak and motionless. I needed help, and the only one who could help me was him. Within 3 days of my first real plea to God, I met two people who would help change my life. I met an attorney at the club and began having dinner with him on the weekends. He was maybe 70 years old, and all he wanted was long dinners at his favorite Japanese restaurant. At the end of every meal, he would hand me an envelope filled with $2,500 in cash. Every Saturday, it was the same deal. He told me there was another plan for me, and that I was too special to be dancing at the club. This money allowed me to stay out of the club and to pursue other interests, such as developing my auditioning and writing abilities. To me, he was an angel on earth. Around this time, I also met a man named Mario. Although I wasn't romantically interested in him, he pursued me intently, and in the process, he became someone I trusted. I was too embarrassed to tell him I was living at a hotel. But when I finally broke down and told him, he allowed me to stay at his apartment. He said he would be moving out of his apartment in a week. It would be vacant and still under lease to him for another month. I was relieved to be out of the hotel and saving the $500 a week that it took to stay there. So now I was making more money and hardly spending any. It was within this period that tax time came around and I received a $10,000 tax refund check for my work on A Man Apart. A month later, it was time to leave Mario's apartment and to find a home of my own. I had the money, but I had two very serious problems. My credit was ruined, and I had never had a legitimate job in my life. When I was married to G, everything had been in my name. When he decided to leave, he also left me with all of the household bills. On the credit scale of 300 to 850, I fell below the radar with a credit score of 416. With all the money in the world, no one was going to accept me as a tenant. It seemed that I would never get out of the mess I was in. I continued to pray and to hold on to faith because I had nothing else. I was on my way to see a friend one day on the promise that he would co-sign on a place for me. I was desperate and willing to try anything. On my way to his apartment, I got off of the main road and began to take the back streets. I did this out of habit and was, in fact, on the same back road I parked on when I had to sleep in my car. Right there was a big, bright banner which read, "Apartment for Rent," with a phone number listed. I fumbled for my phone and began to dial. As the phone rang, I began to think back to those cold nights I spent on that street looking into the windows of other people's homes with envy. There was no rational reason why this building's manager should give me a different answer than the others I had applied to, but I felt positive nonetheless. The phone continued to ring as I drove past the building, and then an answer. With a bit of charm, I set an appointment within the hour. My nerves were bad, and I began to shake. I felt that this could be my last chance. Mario's lease was about to expire, and I didn't want to waste any more money on hotels. This had to work. It just had to. An hour later, a friend accompanied me to view the apartment. It was beautiful, spacious, and perfect. 2 bedrooms, 2 baths, a fireplace, everything I needed within 1,200 square feet. I needed to give my son a sense of security and a feeling of having a place to belong. He had never complained or asked questions. I knew that in his little mind, as long as he was with me, he felt safe. As long as I wore a smile, he would be happy. But I also knew that it was about time that I put my baby first, and this is where I would start. My credit history shocked the manager. There were 34 items listed, and all 34 were negative. He gave me the look. I began to panic and basically pleaded for my life. I began rambling on about my separation from G and how it had kept me from renting a place and about being evicted. I told him how I had been sleeping in and out of my car for 9 months with my son and that I had $10,000 and would give him whatever he needed to make him feel safe about letting me rent from him. I went on and on until the tears began to fall. The look he had given me a few minutes earlier softened. After a few days of phone tag, prayers, and more prayers, I got the call, and a day later, I moved in. It was February 21st, 2002. God was working with me. Now it was time to handle business. I paid the rent for the next 6 months and continued planning the next phase of my life. I was determined to do better, to reflect on my life, pinpoint my mistakes, and make them worth the pain. I would start by no longer being identified as Iset Santiago because Iset wasn't real. Iset thought that she was invincible, but her behavior led to immense self-destruction that not only tore apart her life, but the life of the little boy who depended on her. It was time for me to stop being afraid to be myself. I welcome back Corinne Steffens. There had been so much growth and discovery in my life since I had convulsed on the bathroom floor of Mr. Chow. Since I drove aimlessly around Los Angeles with no place to live, I was grateful and blessed. There are so many things that the average person takes for granted. These are the things that I had taken for granted too in the past. I would never take those things for granted again. There were days in that car when I drove around for hours with my son strapped in the back seat. There were no rest stops on those days, nowhere to wash up or use the bathroom. We didn't have the luxury of television or video games. We didn't have necessities like food or water. The amazing part of it all was that God always allowed me to see people who were worse off than me. I would be in the drive-thru at some fast food place, feeling less of a person because all I had left was $1. And with that $1, I was about to buy my son a 99-cent chicken sandwich. As I dug the nickels and dimes out of my pocket, there before me would be a homeless man or a woman. This happened more than a few times, and I began to heed the message. I had a car, and there were clothes shoved into its trunk. I had 99 cents, and on many days, I had a hotel room I was able to pay for. I appeared to be a queen to others less fortunate. although I was a pauper to myself. With a near drug overdose behind me and the memories of Miami still fresh enough to sustain me, I tried to put the celebrity lifestyle behind me and focus on my new life. I stopped hanging out, going to clubs, meeting my old friends and lovers. But as I sat in my new place with all my ducks in a row, I was revisited by that same old loneliness and realized I had an addictive personality. I became depressed and cried every day through the spring and summer of 2002. I drank heavily and began taking painkillers to ease the pain of my loneliness. I wrote in my journal to try to maintain some sort of sanity. I wanted someone to help me, but there was no one left. While my son was asleep in his room at night, I would lock myself in my bathroom. That's where I kept my tools of destruction, a bottle of Jack Daniels, a knife, cigarettes, and a prescription vial of 500 milligram hydrocodone pills. I lay on the floor, crying, drinking with large, rapid swallows. As the liquor burned my esophagus, I began to cut into my flesh, carving onto my skin the words and names and phrases and people that were swirling in my thoughts. The slicing was so painful, I knew I'd have to take another dose of the powerful painkiller. The room began to spin. I sat back for a moment, leaning against the tub, watching the stream of blood spilling onto the floor. It didn't scare me. If anything, I delighted in the sight. The blood represented the pain leaving my body. I loved the feeling. Ironically, it seemed to make me feel alive again, knowing some of the pain was escaping my raging flesh. I turned 24 in August 2002, the same day that the Soul Train Lady of Soul Awards were in Los Angeles. Consequently, a lot of artists were in town. While walking around with a friend, we ran into Ja. I told him it was my birthday, and he invited us to meet him at his house for a little get-together to celebrate the occasion. I was game. Before going to Ja's house, we drove to Orange County, about 2 hours south of Los Angeles, for a summer series concert where Ja was performing. I felt happy to be there. Ja always had a way of making you feel as if everything was going to be okay. I sat on stage with his crew as he performed, beaming with pride. It was clear how far he'd come from when we'd first met, when he was just beginning his career. Not many people knew who he was then, and if they did, they didn't give him much respect. For a while, we couldn't even get into the clubs around town without paying the bouncer hundreds of dollars, and even then, we sometimes couldn't gain entry. But now, this was his stage, and all of his fans reveled in his star power performance. For the moment, it was 2000 all over again, and I was caught up in it. Later that night, we all went to a local sports bar and had taken up 4 or 5 tables, ordering about 3 bottles of Cristal champagne. We drank and laughed, talked and reminisced. It felt good to be with Ja again and to see people falling over themselves to say hello. That was the high. It was like I was good enough and worthy enough to be with someone so adored. Yet another lie. I was fighting with myself, stuck between my past and my future. And frankly, on this night, my past won, hands down. The party continued back at the house, and soon, Ja and I were in his room behind locked doors. We were drunk by this time and had slipped back into our comfortable old ways. It was like putting on my favorite robe and house slippers. I knew this man. We talked about everything, his life, his career. This was around the time when 50 Cent debuted, and there was still unfinished beef between them. I was taken back to one day in 2000. When Ja called from New York and said he was in trouble. Later that night, he flew into Los Angeles and stayed for almost a year while recording his album, Rule 336. We hung out that night, and Ja told me what the trouble had been. He and Murder, Inc. had somehow become involved in an altercation with 50 Cent in a New York studio, and now, 2 years later, 50 Cent was gaining weight in the industry and speaking out against Ja. As we talked about it, I can see the concern on his face. I tried to be supportive, but deep down, I knew Ja's reign would come to an end, as it does with most artists, and 50 would be his successor, for the moment. Just then, as she had done a couple of years before, Ja's wife called. I sat on the edge of the bed, sipping champagne, listening to them argue. She was in New York and pregnant again with their third child. It was history repeating itself. The only difference was that this time the gripe wasn't about me, but about Ashanti, Murder Inc.'s first lady. Ja's wife was positive that Ja was sleeping with Ashanti, though he denied it. Even I knew that wasn't true. The distraction with Ja was just that, a distraction, and put me in a kind of social limbo. I knew I had to work on changing my ways, and that change would come only with my continued prayer and discipline. I still needed help and would be, for the rest of my life, under construction. Still, even as I teetered between worlds, I welcomed my mistakes, because from them would come my salvation. I tried to share the lessons I was learning with a friend, Merlin Santana, who I befriended in April 2000, not long after I arrived in Los Angeles. I had first seen Merlin as a child actor when he appeared on The Cosby Show, and at this time he was a cast member of The Steve Harvey Show, playing the hunky high school heartthrob, Romeo. When we first met, we were instantly attracted to each other, and over the next 2 years would maintain a relationship which would be more off than on. In October 2002, I received a call from Chuck. He heard that Merlin was looking for me, which was strange since I had not been in touch with him for almost a year. I was curious and needed to know why the frantic rush to find me. Hours later, Merlin called. We caught up on the latest events of each other's life and vowed to keep in touch. In the back of my mind, though, I still didn't understand. It just seemed odd to me that after all this time, he would start this chain of events to find me. There was something bigger in motion, but I didn't know what. More conversations between us followed, and soon he came to visit me at my home. The first visit was late, around 2 a.m. I had just left the party given by Wesley Snipes at his house in Venice Beach. Merlin called as he was leaving a club. I could hear in his voice that something was wrong, and I wanted to help. I knew him and his habit of roaming the streets all hours of the night and early morning. I wanted him to visit me and let me know what was going on with him, with the hope of keeping him off the streets, if only for one night. After I arrived home, he called me from his truck. I told him the code to buzz himself into the security gate. After 2 minutes, he still hadn't buzzed. After I called to see where he was, we both realized he was at the wrong building. He seemed disoriented, so I stayed on the phone and reeled him in. When he reached my front door, he looked awful. He was wearing a filthy white t-shirt that was ripped and blue sweatpants that were washed out and appeared dirty. His face was oily and also seemed as though it hadn't been washed in days. This wasn't the conceited, meticulous Merlin who I had once known. For the next 3 hours, we sat on my sofa and talked. The things he said were shocking, and I realized just how lost he was. Merlin took me back to his abusive childhood, things he had never shared with anyone. I cried with him because I knew his pain. He told me he hadn't been feeling worthy since the Steve Harvey Show had been canceled. He thought the cancellation of the show was why he wasn't being respected by people and at the local clubs, which no longer allowed him entry. I saw a lot of me in him, the longing to be accepted and justified, the pain of early childhood abuse, the sense of emptiness within. Merlin would ride around all night looking for places to go, places to belong. He also reminded me of the person I was trying not to be. I began to tell him about the transformations I had made and how I felt that God was working on me every day to make me a better person. I said, "Find your nucleus and get on your knees and pray. Stay out of the streets and recognize the messages that are being sent to you." He said, "I don't know how to pray." I continued, "You have to realize that not getting into the club wasn't a personal attack on your manhood, but a message from God to just go home. Roaming the streets will kill you if you can't humble yourself and ask God to show you what to do. All you have to do is ask." With tears in his eyes, he told me, "If you and I were together again, I would have a reason to stay home. You could change me if you would just give me another chance." His words sounded sincere, but I knew better. I told him of all the things I had learned thus far, but that I still had a very long way to go. Merlin looked me square in the eye and told me he couldn't do those things, that he didn't know how. It hurt to hear him accept defeat before trying. With that, he was ready to leave. It was 5 a.m, and he left to roam the streets again. It wouldn't be the last time I saw Merlin. The following week, he came back. But this time, his visit frightened me. It seemed as if those first few seconds we were together passed in slow motion. I answered my door to see him cloaked in black. On anyone else, this would have been nothing, but for some reason, the color was symbolic of his life. He was living in a shroud of darkness. Merlin had forgotten his blue and white pinstriped Yankees hat during his last visit and came to retrieve it. We lay on my bed that night and talked some more. He assumed I didn't want to be with him because his show was canceled. "You'll want me when I'm back on, and I'll come back for you." We kissed that night, as we had during his initial visit, and it felt wrong. I told him that nothing sexual would happen, but I would like for him to stay. He was hungry, and I was prepared to feed him and maybe watch a movie. Anything would be better than letting him go back into the streets again. But Merlin refused to stay, and at 4:45 in the morning, he left my place. He was disoriented, not even able to find his way out of the bedroom door. I begged him to stay with me for the night, but only sex would keep him with me, something I just couldn't give him. My life was changing, and I knew in my heart that what I was telling him was right and true. God had given it to me, and I was here to give it to him. Merlin just couldn't receive it. I cried as he left. 5 days later, on November 10th, 2002, Merlin was shot dead in the early morning hours while sitting in a car. I would never be the same. Chapter 16. Dog Eat Dog World. Merlin's death solidified the end of an era for me. I recall the nights that he and I had spent cruising the streets of Los Angeles, sometimes until nearly sunrise. The things I'd shared with him as he cried on my sofa were things that I myself had just learned. I knew in my heart that if he had just been able to listen to me, he could very well still be alive today. I also knew that it was time for me to heed my own warnings and hear my own advice. Although many things about my life had changed, there were still many changes left to be made as it became more obvious that old habits died hard, including my relationship with DMX. He and I had known each other in passing for about a year, and in November of 2002, we consummated our friendship and built an intimate bond. We spent most days driving around town, going to parties, and sometimes just lying around the hotel eating cereal. We spent plenty of nights playing pool at bars and flying model airplanes with my son at the park. DMX is notorious for his erratic style of driving. He would easily punch 80 miles an hour around a bend and never wore a seatbelt, stating, "It's not accidents that kill people, seatbelts kill people." At one point, I was so afraid for my life that I opted to jump out of the Mercedes CLK he was driving as it approached a red light, rather than drive with him. I remember him saying to me during a fight, "You ain't never met a nigga like me, because if you'd ever met a nigga like me, you'd be in love." He was right. I had loved him from the moment we met. But I was also very aware of how dangerous that love could be if I took it seriously. Aside from his usual antics, D was actually sweet and loving. He was always with me, by my side, kissing and hugging me. I would tell him, "I need some love," and he would stop whatever he was doing to hold me and kiss my face. On one occasion, while we were out at the Saddle Ranch restaurant on Sunset Boulevard, he bought me 100 roses. He had a way about him that made me feel special. He began to refer to me as the baby, and I felt protected and cared for. He accepted me for what I had been and loved me just the same. We had an explosive sex life and an even more explosive relationship. During sex, he would growl, scratch, and bite like a dog, and then whimper at orgasm. It was so unusual, so animalistic, it turned me on. It wasn't uncommon for those around us to see us fight. During a meeting with video director Joseph Kahn, Dee and I began to argue about another woman he was seeing. I grabbed all the tiny liquor bottles from the minibar and hurled them at Dee's head. Quite the ducker, he managed to dodge every single one. Our guests were in awe. The fight carried on into the lobby, where I threw Lemonhead candies at his face as hard as I could. The staff at the Los Angeles W Hotel came to know us for our raving and sometimes comical arguments. We grew closer over the next 3 years, even spending Thanksgiving of 2004 together. Still, no matter how close Dee and I became, he was still a married man who had many other women. No matter how special he made me feel, there were a lot of women in his life who felt the same way I did. Our sexual relationship has long since ended, but from time to time we can still be seen tearing up the streets of Los Angeles with our combustible yet reliable friendship and chemistry, one based on unconditional acceptance. While the majority of the late nights were gone and I was living a more stable lifestyle with my son, my inner demons still ate at me. I would drive my son to preschool every morning, just like other moms. My writing became a welcome relief from my own thoughts. Putting everything on paper cleared some of the inner conflict I was experiencing. Slowly, some normalcy crept into my life. I was home every night for dinner and there to read my son a bedtime story. But when he was asleep and the house was quiet and all the chores of the day were done, I felt an incredible emptiness. I spent most of those nights crying, depressed, and lonely. I was paying the toll for all the years of misjudgments in my life. Though I had given up cutting myself, the loneliness still ate away at me. I filled the emptiness with another body, Bobby Brown. Bobby was a longtime associate of G and Chuck, but it was Irv Gotti who introduced us in the same way that he introduced me and Diddy. We met on October 16, 2002, and from that day, he did everything in his power to spend time with me in Los Angeles. Bobby was loving and generous. Our relationship didn't last long because in addition to his high-profile marriage to Whitney Houston, I also realized there was a serious problem. I never witnessed him use drugs, but I did witness behavior which made me think if he wasn't on drugs, he needed to be committed. Bobby would nod off at odd times. I remember talking to him while he sat on the toilet, nodding off continually during the conversation. I knew something wasn't right, but it would take a while for me to figure out just how wrong things were. I easily became a part of Bobby's Los Angeles circle, including his goddaughter, who I had known for years before meeting him. He had plenty of friends in Los Angeles, and they would help us keep in touch while Bobby was back in Atlanta, where he and Whitney have a home. His brother, nephews, and bodyguards were all aware of our relationship. Even his oldest son, who lives in Los Angeles, knew about me. Eventually, I was told that Whitney had become very aware of our relationship as well. Bobby and Whitney were going through what seemed to be a brief separation. She spent months at the side of her ailing father in New Jersey. While Bobby was left to fend for himself, he and I found ways and reasons for him to come to Los Angeles to spend time with me. We spent a couple of weeks at the Ritz in Marina Del Rey, a waterfront community just 20 minutes south of Beverly Hills. The staff at the hotel addressed me as Miss Brown. I can't imagine what they must have thought. Bobby and I casually and publicly traipsed through the hotel, hugging, kissing, and carrying on. We would have dinner with friends as well as with his oldest son and nephews. We had lunch at beachfront restaurants in plain view of the world, and on one occasion we fed each other raw oysters for 2 hours at a popular seafood restaurant close to the Santa Monica Pier. He never missed an opportunity to tell me he loved me, and my eyes would dance as I returned the notion. But there were still many things about Bobby that worried me. While we were at the Ritz, I was going through Bobby's pockets in order to grab some money for the dinner I had just ordered. In his pocket, I found an ATM card with only his wife's name on it. I also found an ATM receipt which showed the checking account balance to be a little less than $15,000. This was the first clue that things weren't what they seemed with him. He told me he had plenty of money and access to all of his wife's money, but this ATM receipt showed that he was on a pretty tight leash, at least while he was away from home. He even said he was going to find a home to be closer to me in Los Angeles. After I found the ATM card, Bobby walked into the room in a state of confusion. It was February 2003 and we had just spent Valentine's Day together. He and Whitney were on the phone arguing about a headline that had appeared in the National Enquirer, which told the true story of a fight they'd had in the Bahamas some time before. Bobby believed most of the stories were planted by people sympathetic to her, and he was tired of everyone saying he was the one who got her hooked on cocaine. "I don't want to do drugs anymore," he said. All of a sudden, all of his habits and strange, erratic behavior began to make sense to me. Again, I have never seen him do drugs, but his words provided clarity for me. Bobby would cry at times for no reason, and he often said he needed a way out. He was clearly very unhappy. Bobby then walked out of the room and stayed gone for almost 2 hours. When he returned, he seemed to be under the influence of something and began speaking nonsense. He told me he was a member of Al-Qaeda and that President Bush was looking for him. He said he knew where Osama bin Laden was and who was behind the September 11th terrorist attacks. He also said he and I had to board a private jet right away and head to the Middle East. He went on like this for a couple of hours, until 4 in the morning, and I was ready for bed. My son had been sleeping in the other room, and I didn't want to start a fight and wake him, so I listened until I couldn't stand it any longer. "I'm not listening to this bullshit anymore," I then screamed. Bobby got irate and told me to get my son and get out. Here he was, making up delusional stories at 4 in the morning, and just because I didn't feel like entertaining his bullshit, I was being disrespected. So I did what any woman in my position might do. I slapped Bobby in his mouth with all my might. He calmed down and eventually fell asleep, but I wondered how much more I could take. I had become such a staple in the life of Bobby Brown that he had told his mother about his girlfriend in LA, and I was even allowed to call him at the home he shared with Whitney in Atlanta. On one occasion, he and Whitney were in Los Angeles together and staying at the Bel Air Hotel. She had a very bad cold and cough and was in the room with him when I called. He answered the phone and I said, "Come see me." He began to say that it would be impossible, but I demanded. "Okay, baby," he said. A couple of hours later, he was with me at my house. We stood in my kitchen making dinner together and later watched a movie while lying in bed. He stayed the night and went back to his wife in the morning. I loved Bobby, and he loved me at the time, and everyone around us knew and accepted it for what it was. Yet toward the end of our relationship, reality began to set in. At one point, while we were staying at the Ritz, Bobby had run out of money and we were all kicked out of the hotel. It went downhill from there. He began to treat me badly from time to time, and when I cried about it, he would once again become the loving, sensitive man he'd been when we first met. We went back and forth until I finally left Bobby in April of 2003. We had been staying at L'Hermitage. Every day we fought and made up. I left for one night to get my head together. The next morning, I received a phone call from one of Bobby's oldest friends, telling me he had been with a known hooker the night before. I'm not sure what happened, but what I heard made my stomach turn. I hurried over to the hotel and waited in the lobby for Bobby to come out of his room. 2 hours later, he appeared, and I handed him a note. Among other things, the note said, "It's time for us to go our separate ways. What we had together had been wrong from the start, and I needed to move on." Bobby had actually grown during our 6 months together. He would often tell me that I made him want to be a better person, and now he was. He was clean and sober, as far as I knew, and was looking better than ever. I like to think I helped him clean up his act a little. But Bobby did something for me as well. Our relationship left me exhausted, and it was the last time I would start a relationship with a married man. As much as I hated to admit it, I was following the same path as my mother. I was repeating the cycle of being used and reused and allowing it. Bobby was the last straw. He watched me walk toward my car as he hopped in his SUV and drove behind me. I did not look back. Just a few days later, after Bobby and I finally split, A Man Apart premiered at Grauman's Chinese Theater in Hollywood, 2.5 years after filming. I had been fitted and styled for the event just as I had been for many other events around town. By this time, I'd hired a publicist for the months leading up to the premiere in order to generate publicity and acquire invites to all the top Hollywood parties and premieres. I became well-versed in the craft of styling and red carpet behavior. Essentially, I was ready for the evening. Yet, I felt inadequate. I wasn't at all excited about the A Man Apart premiere and decided not to go. I didn't feel pretty or like much of a movie star, so I lay in bed, drinking a couple of Corona beers. After about an hour, and just 20 minutes before the start of the red carpet arrivals, I found the courage to get dressed, smear on some lip gloss, and drive myself to Grauman's. I parked my Mustang in the underground garage at the Hollywood and Highland complex and took the long walk to the red carpet. Nothing about that night thus far had made me feel like a star, not until the paparazzi began snapping their cameras and calling my name. I spent the first 45 minutes after my arrival on the red carpet, having my pictures taken and talking to press people from the likes of Entertainment Tonight, Access Hollywood, and Extra. I began to feel confident and beautiful, and was happy to see all of my fellow cast members. I was especially happy to look over my shoulder and see my friend Magic Johnson giving me the thumbs up and saying, "Good job." The premiere gave me a sense of grand accomplishment that fulfilled me more than any man ever could. The premiere was not the first time that I'd seen a man apart, but coupled with the excitement and ambiance of the night, seeing myself on screen made me proud. Vin and I shared a long grinding hug before the viewing of the film and made plans to meet after the premiere and the post-premiere party. I was floating on air, and that tiny taste of independence and professional acceptance put my list of goals and priorities into high gear. I started to form a plan and began to feel stronger and more secure on my own. I was determined to find success and to be happy alone. I knew there had to be other women who felt empty and confused all their lives, and I thought, if they could make it on their own, so could I. I began to get my finances in order so I could clean up my credit. Determined not to need a man for anything, I opened my own massage company, employed a few women and men, and saved the bulk of my earnings. I could see myself becoming more of the woman I was hoping to be. Over the next few months, I continued to be focused and to work hard toward my personal and professional goals. Life became relatively boring, which was a twist. I shut down my massage business in order to devote all of my time to writing. I had always kept a journal, but now I was starting to write about the events that had led me to this moment. Papa, who remains a friend and confidant, chipped in when necessary and made sure things were taken care of if I needed his help. It felt good to have someone who really knew me and supported me all the way. Although we had our disagreements and occasional fallouts, Papa had never once judged me, and unlike everyone else, he stood by me through the dreamlike highs and the devastating lows of my past. Chapter 17. Superhead. After I began to write, I shared my ideas with Damon Dash while visiting him one afternoon at the Beverly Hills Hotel. Although Damon and I had been casually acquainted over the past 3 years, there was a lot about me he had never known. I started to tell him about my life and why I wanted to write about it, and his face froze with shock. I was still unsure about the idea of writing and didn't know if my life story would appeal to other people, but as I began to tell it to those around me, their reactions said it all. Damon immediately called Fox Searchlight, and the very next day, a Fox executive met with us and brought director Ben Younger of Boiler Room to meet me and hear my story. Everyone was fascinated and sure that this could be translated into a motion picture. Soon, I was telling the story to Shakem Compare, manager and business partner to Queen Latifah. He too was amazed and convinced that my story would make a good motion picture. Not too long after telling Shakem, I repeated the story to well-known music executive Andre Harrell while sitting poolside at the St. Regis Hotel in Los Angeles. Again, I was met with enthusiasm, but it was Andre who insisted that my life story would be better served as a book. I was doubtful and afraid. Writing a book seemed such an intimidating idea, but every time I saw Andre after our talk, usually at the Four Seasons popular Sunday brunch, he would insist, "You need to write that book." I was telling some of the most influential men in the entertainment business about my life and my idea of writing about it, and they were unanimous in their opinion. It was necessary to write my story because I had something to say, and it should be heard by young women everywhere. I became more confident and convinced I could make this happen with a little help from my friends. The following December, I was called to do a spread for Smooth Magazine's Hollywood Swimsuit issue in connection to my appearance in A Man Apart. I took the opportunity to briefly mention my upcoming project and a bit about my life, hoping it would start a small buzz that would eventually get the ball rolling. Every night, I would sit up in bed and go over my plan. There was a way for me to harness the pain and mistakes in my life to warn others to stay away from the lure and seduction that had gripped me. This marked the beginning of a new era in my life, and suddenly the pain of my past didn't haunt me as much. I could finally see my 5-year plan, just as Exhibit had seen his during our fateful Miami trip. By the time Christmas came around, I could see a definite change on the horizon. In February of 2004, the Hollywood swimsuit issue of Smooth magazine hit newsstands. The other magazines, Vibe and XXL, followed. The shoots were fun, but more important, I used the exposure as a way to launch another business. My partner, Smart Girl Productions, and I trademarked and incorporated the term superhead, which I learned has a different connotation abroad, a positive one affiliated with higher learning, especially in the UK, and formed an apparel line bearing the name. Taking ownership of my life felt good. Instead of hiding from my past, I wanted to face it and show other women that no matter how one's life may have started out, it's never too late to grow and to change. Ironically, my darkest days would be the fuel for this new fire in my life. Finally, I wasn't dependent on others for a purpose and would soon learn that wealth is internal. Even with the fast-paced flashiness of my past, I was never comfortable in my own skin. That's what mattered most, not the things that adorned my skin, but how I felt in it. Chapter 18, Ushering In. During my transformation, many old acquaintances were being left behind as new ones took their place. But one night, what was old became new again in the form of Usher Raymond. In November 2004, I was dining with an acquaintance at the Los Angeles W Hotel restaurant and lounge, and I decided to leave at around 1 in the morning. As I walked down the front steps and toward the valet, I stopped to look up to see if my guest was behind me. He stood at the top of the stairs talking, and just then, someone came out of the W and motioned for me to walk toward him. As I approached this stranger, he introduced himself to me. "Hi, my name is Keith and I work for Usher. Usher's in the building right now and would like to speak to you for a moment, if you would follow me." Usher and I spoke for a couple of minutes that night as we stood in the middle of the heavily guarded VIP section at the W's bar and restaurant. I noticed that we were being watched, so I gave Usher my number and told him to call me the next night, which he did. Usher and I had first met back in 2000 on the steps of that very same hotel. I was leaving after having dinner, and he was just checking in. "Where are you going?" he asked softly as we crossed paths. I replied, "With you," and made an immediate U-turn. Usher and I spent the next several months together whenever he was in Los Angeles. What I remember most about our time together is taking breaks for long talks and bouts of laughter, eating Subway sandwiches in bed, and ordering late-night room service, logging in long nights at the studio, watching him belt out singles for his then-upcoming album 8701, making love every chance we could get. He was 20 years old then, and I was 21. Usher was quiet and very attentive, always asking if I was all right or if I needed anything. He was a simple man without the constant security and Maybach Mercedes-Benz he travels with now. When he wasn't in Los Angeles, we would frequently keep in contact via telephone and two-way pager. He became a part of my life, and my feelings for him continued to grow until he fell in love with Chili, one-third of the group TLC. Over the next 2 years, as he and his relationship with Chili matured, Usher and I lost touch. After reuniting in late 2004, Usher and I began to see each other once again. I instantly saw a change in him and in the dynamic of our relationship. The soft and tender person I had known before was still there, but was often superseded by his more aloof side. I would be drawn in by his tender words and touch, only to be pushed away in a moment of cold reaction. On one particular night, I spent an hour or two in the lobby of his hotel having drinks with his manager, personal assistant, and younger brother James. Usher joined us, and after a while, he and I ventured upstairs to his suite. Turned on by his presence, I ripped off his clothes, dropped to my knees, and ravished him. Usher seemed to be turned on by commanding me to do things sexually in a tone I found condescending and disrespectful. He stopped me from pleasuring him and began to question why I was there. He seemed under the impression that I hadn't found love, that I was lost and confused in life. But he was wrong. The old Corinne might have been looking for love, for salvation, but the new Corinne saw the search for what it was. I wasn't here because I was lonely or looking for my next high, emotional or otherwise. I was here because, given our past history and the friendship I believed we shared, I felt free to be adventurous with him. I wanted him to be the same man I had known 5 years earlier, but was surprised to find him much cockier and more withdrawn. He and I often battled for control of the situation. Many times we would have loud, uproarious fights. I remember the time his 20-year-old brother James and I had been playfully flirting all night as a sort of running joke. From what I could tell, Usher took that as a sign that I wanted James and spitefully offered me his brother. "I saw you guys flirting, so why don't you just give him what you were going to give me?" I shouted. "If I wanted to fuck your brother, he'd be fucked. I don't need your permission." As he was screaming, "Bitch, get the fuck out," I was already out the door and down the hall. As the elevator doors opened, I took my first step into it, only to be dragged back by Usher. I felt he was playing a mental tug of war with me, and it seemed to be turning him on. It wasn't the sex he wanted me for. It was the emotional manipulation. As usual, the night ended with apologies as we lay together on the couch, my head on his chest. For the time being, my tender friend was back. That type of disrespectful behavior would continue, and every time I saw him would be worse than the last. We fought and made up over and over again. As a result, my relationship with Usher became more stressful. Being with him had initially been comfortable and familiar. I genuinely liked him and felt he was a beautiful man inside and out, despite the changes that had come with his success. On December 23, 2004, I received a call from Usher's personal assistant and manager telling me they were planning a surprise for him, and I was eager to participate. The three of us piled into a black BMW 760 V12, and I disrobed in the back seat and adorned myself with a hotel robe. We drove to the set of Dying for Dolly, the movie Usher was in the middle of filming. I waited in the back seat as the guys went to fetch Usher from his trailer. As Usher piled into the back seat, he smiled as his eyes became focused on my naked body. Yet, he didn't seem very surprised. Per my request, Usher's song, Lovers and Friends, played over and over as we pulled off and headed to the Century City Plaza, Park Hyatt. I instantly took all of him into my mouth. He was immediately aroused and lay back in ecstasy while touching my most intimate parts. I'd had more than my share of martinis at the bar before arriving on the set, and it seemed as if I reached my sexual peak all at once in the back seat with him. With every touch, I shivered. With every lick, he squirmed. I was ready, and so was he, and before we knew it, we had arrived at the hotel. The driveway of the hotel was full of college students from Michigan State who were in town for the Rose Bowl, not to mention hotel staff, guests, and visitors. Still, there was no hesitation as Usher and I walked into the hotel side by side. He held his head high as I walked beside him, holding the bathrobe together with just one hand and my hair a mess. We were being obvious. And Usher loved it. In the hotel room, everything was just as usual. We enjoyed each other's company at first, and then came another one of his talks. He was working so hard to build me up, then belittle me, when all I wanted to do was share some time with my lover and friend. Then, to add insult to injury, after our simultaneous orgasms, Usher walked out of the suite without saying a word to me. I found out he was with another woman in the suite next door. I had had enough. He was no longer the man I had known 5 years before, and I was worth more than he would ever be willing to give. I gathered my things and went home. Epilogue. Although the quality of my life has changed, I still enjoy an exciting lifestyle with celebrity colleagues, friends, and lovers. The difference is that now I am my own woman and look for no one to complete me. I make my own living and am fully aware of my worth. Still, my life is not perfect, and naturally, I make mistakes from which I can only hope to learn. My life has been an amazing ride, and there are a lot of things that had to be done to get to the point of peace and acceptance where I am now. By the grace of God, I made it through a traumatizing childhood went from being an exotic dancer and a teenage runaway to being a wife and mother in just a few short years, all before I turned 20 years old. I escaped death at the hand of a tyrant husband, only to be thrust into the dizzying grip of the Los Angeles party life. I was loved by a then self-proclaimed pimp, seduced by an entire industry, and consequently got so caught up that I was convinced I was one of them, a star with seemingly endless reserves of wealth, access, and power. It couldn't have been further from the truth. I was also in love with love, and all the stories I had heard and read about it. I needed it so badly that I settled for a love of my own creation and imagination too many times. In my heart, I had loved them all, and it is clear to me now that none of them had ever loved me. I've lived the kind of life which could easily have killed some people and driven many others insane. I am a strong believer in the adage, to whom much is given, much is required. As I grow older, I realize that I had to go through it all in order to reach my destiny in life. I had to be who I am in order to help the thousands of young girls who write to me on my website to ask for advice. I used to pity myself, but now I rejoice in who I have become and I'm excited about who I will be. Sure, I still have my connections and acquaintances in the business of entertainment, but now I only do things that add happiness to my life. It's easier for me to walk away from things and people that don't uplift me. And finally, I am in love, and it has nothing to do with the man in my life or any other man I've ever come across. I'm in love with my son and the life that we have together. Life is normal now, and I no longer crave the lifestyle I used to. There are blockbuster movie nights and dinner parties at home with friends, PTA meetings and birthday parties for my son and his classmates, watching him play football on Saturdays and lazy Sundays in bed with nowhere to go. And it feels good. Would I do it all again? Yes. If someone told me that I have to relive my entire life in order to be as fulfilled as I am now, then I would. I am stronger for it, and I am able to be who I was always meant to be. I find incredible hope in the people who have been inspired by my life and whose lives have inspired mine.
Salute, and thank you all that watched all three parts of this 3 out of 3 series, guys. I hope you was entertained. I hope you was highly informed and educated. This book was influential in a lot of ways, guys. And ladies, I hope you can learn from her mistakes. Learn from these celebrities. Don't try to worship them. Don't try to be like them. You want to learn from these celebrities, guys. All right? Now, y'all wrap up, strap up, drink responsibly. Do not play with your life, guys. I appreciate y'all. And thanks for joining the membership, guys. Thanks for becoming a member to the channel. We will also have the Mob D, and we will have the Slim. We will have the Iceberg Slim final editions here at the $199 membership package here at the Mr. Goodbread Reaction Channel. I appreciate y'all. Thank y'all, guys.